"Aye," said Aragorn, and stared at the length of polished hawthorn. "I spoke with her." "To what end?" When Aragorn did not immediately reply, Rohan uttered a frustrated exclamation. "Getting answers out of you is harder than dragging Birka through the mud!" Aragorn chuckled at the mention of Birka, one of their draft horses. "Saphira, will you solve this puzzle for me? Otherwise I fear I'll never get a full explanation." "To no end. No end at all. She'll not have me." Aragorn spoke dispassionately, as if commenting on a stranger's misfortune. But within him raged a torrent of hurt so deep and wild, he felt Saphira withdraw somewhat from him. "I'm sorry," said Rohan. Aragorn forced a swallow past the lump in his throat, past the bruise that was his heart, and down to the knotted skein of his stomach. "It happens. I know it may seem unlikely at the moment," said Rohan. "But I'm sure you will meet another woman who will make you forget this Arya. There are countless mates, and more than a few married women, I'd wager, who would be delighted to catch the eye of a rider. You'll have no trouble finding a wife among all the lovelies in Alagazia." "And what would you have done if Katrina rejected your suit?" The question struck Rohan dumb. It was obvious he could not imagine how he might have reacted. Aragorn continued, "Contrary to what you, Arya, and everyone else seem to believe, I am aware that other eligible women exist in Alagazia, and that people have been known to fall in love more than once. No doubt if I spent my days in the company of ladies from King Oren's court, I might indeed decide that I fancy one. However, my path is not so easy as that. Regardless of whether I can shift my affections to another, and the heart, as you observed, is a notoriously fickle beast, the question remains, should I?" "Your tongue has grown as twisted as the roots of a fir tree," said Rohan. "Speak not in riddles." "Very well. What human woman can begin to understand who and what I am, or the extent of my powers? Who could share in my life? Few enough, and all of them magicians. And of that select group, or even of women in general, how many are immortal?" Rohan laughed, a rough, hearty bellow that rang loud in the gulch. "You might as well ask for the sun in your pocket, or—" He stopped and tensed, as if he were about to spring forward, and then became unnaturally still. "You cannot be." "I am." Rohan struggled to find words. "Is it the result of your change in Ellesmira? Or is it part of being a rider?" "Part of being a rider." "That explains why Galbatorix hasn't died." "Aye." The branch Rohan had added to the fire burst asunder with a muted pop, as the coals underneath heated the gnarled length of wood to the point where a small cache of water or sap that had somehow evaded the rays of the sun for untold decades exploded into steam. "The idea is so vast, it's almost inconceivable," said Rohan. "Death is part of who we are. It guides us, it shapes us, it drives us to madness. Can you still be human if you have no mortal end?" "I'm not invincible," Aragorn pointed out. "I can still be killed with a sword or an arrow, and I can still catch some incurable disease. But if you avoid those dangers, you will live forever." "If I do, then yes. Saphira and I will endure." "It seems both a blessing and a curse." I cannot in good conscience marry a woman who will age and die while I remain untouched by time. Such an experience would be equally cruel for both of us. On top of that, I find the thought of taking one wife after another throughout the long centuries rather depressing." "Can you make someone immortal with magic?" asked Rohan. You can darken white hair, you can smooth wrinkles and remove cataracts, and if you are willing to go to extraordinary lengths, you can give a 60-year-old man the body he had at 19. However, the elves have never discovered a way to restore a person's mind without destroying his or her memories. And who wants to erase their identity every so many decades in exchange for immortality? It would be a stranger, then, who lived on. An old brain in a young body isn't the answer either, for even with the best of health, that which we humans are made of can only last for a century, perhaps a bit more. Nor can you just stop someone from aging. That causes a whole host of other problems. Oh, elves and men have tried 1,001 different ways to foil death, but none have proved successful. In other words, said Roran, it's safer for you to love Arya than to leave your heart free for the taking by a human woman. Who else can I marry but an elf? Especially considering how I look now. Aragorn quelled the desire to reach up and finger the curved tips of his ears, a habit he had fallen into. When I lived in Ellesmere, it was easy for me to accept how the dragons had changed my appearance. After all, they gave me many gifts besides. Also, the elves were friendlier toward me after the Agaiti Blodron. It was only when I rejoined the Varden that I realized how different I'd become. It bothers me, too. I'm no longer just human, and I'm not quite an elf. I'm something else in between. A mix. A half-breed.
Cheer up, said Roran. You may not have to worry about living forever. Galbatorix, Murtagh, the Razak, or even one of the Empire's soldiers could put steel through us at any moment. A wise man would ignore the future and drink and carouse while he still has an opportunity to enjoy this world.
I know what Father would say to that.
And he'd give us a good hiding to boot.
They shared a laugh, and then the silence that so often intruded on their discussion asserted itself once again. A gap born of equal parts weariness, familiarity, and conversely, the many differences that fate had created between those who had once gone about lives that were but variations on a single melody.
You should sleep, said Saphira to Aragorn and Roran. It's late, and we must rise early tomorrow.
Aragorn looked at the black vault of the sky, judging the hour by how far the stars had rotated. The night was older than he expected. Sound advice, he said. I just wish we had a few more days to rest before we storm Helgrind. The battle on the Burning Plains drained all of Saphira's strength and my own, and we have not fully recovered, what with flying here and the energy I transferred into the belt of Beloth the Wise these past 2 evenings. My limbs still ache, and I have more bruises than I can count. Look! Loosening the ties on the cuff of his left shirt sleeve, he pushed back the soft lamare, a fabric the elves made by cross-weaving wool and nettle threads, revealing a rancid yellow streak where his shield had mashed against his forearm.
Ha! Said Roran. You call that tiny little mark a bruise? I hurt myself worse when I bumped my toe this morning. Here, I'll show you a bruise a man can be proud of.
He unlaced his left boot, pulled it off, and rolled up the leg of his trousers to expose a black stripe as wide as Aragorn's thumb, that slanted across his quadriceps. I caught the haft of a spear as a soldier was turning about.
Impressive, but I have even better.
Ducking out of his tunic, Aragorn yanked his shirt free of his trousers and twisted to the side so that Roran could see the large blotch on his ribs and the similar discoloration on his belly.
Arrows, he explained.
Then he uncovered his right forearm, revealing a bruise that matched the one on his other arm, given when he had deflected a sword with his bracer. Now Roran bared a collection of irregular blue-green spots, each the size of a gold coin, that marched from his left armpit down to the base of his spine, the result of having fallen upon a jumble of rocks and embossed armor. Aragorn inspected the lesions, then chuckled and said, "Pshaw, those are pinpricks. Did you get lost and run into a rose bush? I have one that puts those to shame." He removed both his boots, then stood and dropped his trousers, so that his only garb was his shirt and woolen underpants. "Top that, if you can," he said, and pointed to the inside of his thighs. A riotous combination of colours mottled his skin, as if Aragorn were an exotic fruit that was ripening in uneven patches, from crab-apple green to putrefied purple. "Ouch," said Roran. "What happened?" "I jumped off Saphira when we were fighting Murtagh and Thorn in the air. That's how I wounded Thorn. Saphira managed to dive under me and catch me before I hit the ground, but I landed on her back a bit harder than I wanted to." Roran winced and shivered at the same time. "Does it go all the way?" He trailed off and made a vague gesture upward. "Unfortunately. I have to admit, that's a remarkable bruise. You should be proud. It's quite a feat to get injured in the manner you did, and in that particular place. I'm glad you appreciate it." "Well," said Roran, "you may have the biggest bruise, but the Razak dealt me a wound the likes of which you cannot match, since the dragons, as I understand, removed the scar from your back." While he spoke, he divested himself of his shirt and moved farther into the pulsing light of the coals. Aragorn's eyes widened, before he caught himself and concealed his shock behind a more neutral expression. He berated himself for overreacting, thinking, "It can't be that bad." But the longer he studied Roran, the more dismayed he became. A long, puckered scar, red and glossy, wrapped around Roran's right shoulder, starting at his collarbone and ending just past the middle of his arm. It was obvious that the Razak had severed part of the muscle, and that the two ends had failed to heal back together. For an unsightly bulge deformed the skin below the scar, where the underlying fibres had recoiled upon themselves. Farther up, the skin had sunk inward, forming a depression half an inch deep. "Roran, you should have shown this to me days ago. I had no idea the Razak hurt you so badly. Do you have any difficulty moving your arm?"
"Not to the side or back," said Roran. He demonstrated. "But in the front, I can only lift my hand about as high as mid-chest."
Grimacing, he lowered his arm. "Even that's a struggle. I have to keep my thumb level, or else my arm goes dead. The best way I've found is to swing my arm around from behind and let it land on whatever I'm trying to grasp. I skinned my knuckles a few times before I mastered the trick." Aragorn twisted the staff between his hands.
"Should I?"
he asked Saphira.
"I think you must."
"We may regret it tomorrow."
"You will have more cause for regret if Roran dies because he could not wield his hammer when the occasion demanded. If you draw upon the resources around us, you can avoid tiring yourself further."
"You know I hate doing that. Even talking about it sickens me."
"Our lives are more important than an ant's,"
Saphira countered.
"Not to an ant."
"And are you an ant? Don't be glib, Aragorn. It ill becomes you."
With a sigh, Aragorn put down the staff and beckoned to Roran.
"Here, I'll heal that for you."
"You can do that?"
"Obviously."
A momentary surge of excitement brightened Roran's face, but then he hesitated and looked troubled.
"Now? Is that wise?"
"As Saphira said, better I tend to you while I have the chance, lest your injury cost you your life or endanger the rest of us." Roran drew near, and Aragorn placed his right hand over the red scar, while at the same time expanding his consciousness to encompass the trees and the plants and the animals that populated the gulch, save those he feared were too weak to survive his spell. Then Aragorn began to chant in the ancient language. The incantation he recited was long and complex. Repairing such a wound went far beyond growing new skin, and was a difficult matter at best. In this, Aragorn relied upon the curative formulas that he had studied in Ellesmere, and had devoted so many weeks to memorizing. The silvery mark on Aragorn's palm, the Gedway Ignazia, glowed white-hot as he released the magic. A second later, he uttered an involuntary groan as he died three times, once each with two small birds roosting in a nearby juniper, and also with a snake hidden among the rocks. Across from him, Roran threw back his head and bared his teeth in a soundless howl as his shoulder muscle jumped and writhed beneath the surface of his shifting skin. Then it was over. Aragorn inhaled a shuddering breath and rested his head in his hands, taking advantage of the concealment they provided to wipe away his tears before he examined the results of his labor. He saw Roran shrug several times and then stretch and windmill his arms. Roran's shoulder was large and round, the result of years spent digging holes for fence posts, hauling rocks and pitching hay. Despite himself, a needle of envy pricked Aragorn. He might be stronger, but he had never been as muscular as his cousin. Roran grinned. "It's as good as ever. Better, maybe. Thank you." "You're welcome." It was the strangest thing. I actually felt as if I was going to crawl out of my hide, and it itched something terrible. I could barely keep from ripping... "Get me some bread from your saddlebag, would you? I'm hungry." "We just had dinner." "I need a bite to eat after using magic like that." Aragorn sniffed, and then pulled out his kerchief and wiped his nose. He sniffed again. What he had said was not quite true. It was the toll his spell had exacted on the wildlife that disturbed him, not the magic itself. And he feared he might throw up unless he had something to settle his stomach. "You're not ill, are you?" asked Roran.
"No."
With the memory of the deaths he had caused still heavy in his mind, Aragorn reached for the jar of mead by his side, hoping to fend off a tide of morbid thoughts. Something very large, heavy and sharp struck his hand and pinned it against the ground. He winced and looked over to see the tip of one of Saphira's ivory claws digging into his flesh. Her thick eyelid went snick as it flashed across the great big glittering iris she fixed upon him. After a long moment she lifted the claw as a person would a finger, and Aragorn withdrew his hand. He gulped and gripped the hawthorn staff once more, striving to ignore the mead and to concentrate upon what was immediate and tangible, instead of wallowing in dismal introspection. Roran removed a ragged half of sourdough bread from his bags, then paused, and with a hint of a smile said, "Wouldn't you rather have some venison? I didn't finish all of mine." He held out the makeshift spit of seared juniper wood, on which were impaled three clumps of golden brown meat. To Aragorn's sensitive nose, the odour that wafted toward him was thick and pungent, and reminded him of nights he had spent in the spine, and of long winter dinners, where he, Roran, and Garrow had gathered around their stove and enjoyed each other's company, while a blizzard howled outside. His mouth watered. "It's still warm," said Roran, and waved the venison in front of Aragorn. With an effort of will, Aragorn shook his head.
"Just give me the bread."
"Are you sure?"
"It's perfect. Not too tough, not too tender, and cooked with the perfect amount of seasoning. It's so juicy when you take a bite, it's as if you've swallowed a mouthful of Elaine's best stew."
"No, I can't."
"You know you like it."
"Roran, stop teasing me and hand over that bread." "Ah, now see, you look better already. Maybe what you need isn't bread but someone to get your hackles up, eh?" Aragorn glowered at him, then faster than the eye could see snatched the bread away from Roran. That seemed to amuse Roran even more. As Aragorn tore at the loaf, he said,
I don't know how you can survive on nothing but fruit, bread and vegetables. A man has to eat meat if he wants to keep his strength up. Don't you miss it?
More than you can imagine.
Then why do you insist on torturing yourself like this? Every creature in this world has to eat other living beings, even if they are only plants, in order to survive. That is how we are made. Why attempt to defy the natural order of things?
I said much the same in Ella's mirror,
observed Saphira.
But he did not listen to me.
Aragorn shrugged. We already had this discussion. You do what you want. I won't tell you or anyone else how to live. However, I cannot in good conscience eat a beast whose thoughts and feelings I've shared. The tip of Saphira's tail twitched, and her scales clinked against a worn dome of rock that protruded from the ground.
Oh, he's hopeless.
Lifting and extending her neck, Saphira nipped the venison, spit and all, from Roran's other hand. The wood cracked between her serrated teeth as she bit down, and then it and the meat vanished into the fiery depths of her belly.
Mmm, you did not exaggerate,
she said to Roran.
What a sweet and succulent morsel, so soft, so salty, so deliciously delectable. It makes me want to wiggle with delight. You should cook for me more often, Roran Stronghammer. Only next time, I think you should prepare several deer at once. Otherwise, I won't get a proper meal.
Roran hesitated, as if unable to decide whether her request was serious, and, if so, how he could politely extricate himself from such an unlooked-for and rather onerous obligation. He cast a pleading glance at Aragorn, who burst out laughing, both at Roran's expression and at his predicament. The rise and fall of Saphira's sonorous laugh joined with Aragorn's and reverberated throughout the hollow. Her teeth gleamed madder red in the light from the embers. An hour after the three of them had retired, Aragorn was lying on his back alongside Saphira, muffled in layers of blankets against the night cold. All was still and quiet. It seemed as if a magician had placed an enchantment upon the earth, and that everything in the world was bound in an eternal sleep, and would remain frozen and unchanging for evermore, underneath the watchful gaze of the twinkling stars. Without moving, Aragorn whispered in his mind, Saphira?
Yes, little one?
What if I'm right, and he's in Helgrind? I don't know what I should do then. Tell me what I should do.
I cannot, little one. This is a decision you have to make by yourself. The ways of men are not the ways of dragons. I would tear off his head and feast on his body, but that would be wrong for you, I think.
Will you stand by me, whatever I decide?
Always, little one. Now rest. All will be well.
Comforted, Aragorn gazed into the void between the stars and slowed his breathing as he drifted into the trance that had replaced sleep for him. He remained conscious of his surroundings, but against the backdrop of the white constellations, the figures of his waking dreams strode forth and performed confused and shadowy plays, as was their wont. Assault on Helgrind. Daybreak was 15 minutes away when Aragorn rolled upright. He snapped his fingers twice to wake Roran, and then scooped up his blankets and knotted them into a tight bundle. Pushing himself off the ground, Roran did likewise with his own bedding. They looked at each other and shivered with excitement. If I die, said Roran, you will see to Katrina.
I shall.
Tell her then that I went into battle with joy in my heart and her name upon my lips, I shall. Aragorn muttered a quick line in the ancient language. The drop in his strength that followed was almost imperceptible. There. That will filter the air in front of us and protect us from the paralyzing effects of the Razak's breath. From his bags, Aragorn removed his shirt of mail and unwrapped the length of sackcloth he had stored it in. Blood from the fight on the burning plains still encrusted the once shining corselet, and the combination of dried gore, sweat, and neglect had allowed blotches of rust to creep across the rings. The mail was, however, free of tears, as Aragorn had repaired them before they had departed for the Empire. Aragorn donned the leather-backed shirt, wrinkling his nose at the stench of death and desperation that clung to it, then attached chased braces to his forearms and greaves to his shins. Upon his head, he placed a padded arming cap, a mail coif, and a plain steel helm. He had lost his own helm, the one he had worn in Farthendur and that the dwarves had engraved with the crest of Durgrimstingetum, along with his shield, during the aerial duel between Saphira and Thorn. On his hands went mailed gauntlets. Rohan outfitted himself in a similar manner, although he augmented his armour with a wooden shield. A band of soft iron wrapped around the lip of the shield, the better to catch and hold an enemy's sword. No shield encumbered Aragorn's left arm. The hawthorn staff required two hands to wield properly. Across his back, Aragorn slung the quiver, given to him by Queen Islanzadi. In addition to 20 heavy oak arrows fletched with grey goose feathers, the quiver contained the bow with silver fittings that the queen had sung out of a yew tree for him. The bow was already strung and ready for use. Saphira kneaded the soil beneath her feet.
Let us be off!
Leaving their bags and supplies hanging from the branch of a juniper tree, Aragorn and Rohan clambered onto Saphira's back. They wasted no time saddling her. She had worn her tack through the night. The moulded leather was warm, almost hot, underneath Aragorn. He clutched the neck spike in front of him, to steady himself during sudden changes in direction, while Rohan hooked one thick arm around Aragorn's waist and brandished his hammer with the other. A piece of shale cracked under Saphira's weight as she settled into a low crouch, and in a single giddy bound leaped up to the rim of the gulch, where she balanced for a moment before unfolding her massive wings. The thin membranes thrummed as Saphira raised them toward the sky. Vertical, they looked like two translucent blue sails.
Not so tight, grunted Aragorn.
Sorry, said Rohan. He loosened his embrace. Further speech became impossible, as Saphira jumped again. When she reached the pinnacle, she brought her wings down with a mighty whoosh, driving the three of them even higher. With each subsequent flap, they climbed closer to the flat, narrow clouds. As Saphira angled toward Helgrind, Aragorn glanced to his left and discovered that he could see a broad swath of Leona Lake some miles distant. A thick layer of mist, grey and ghostly in the pre-dawn glow, emanated from the water, as if witchfire burned upon the surface of the liquid. Aragorn tried, but even with his hawk-like vision, he could not make out the far shore, nor the southern reaches of the spine beyond, which he regretted. It had been too long since he had laid eyes upon the mountain range of his childhood. To the north stood Dras Leona, a huge, rambling mass that appeared as a blocky silhouette against the wall of mist that edged its western flank. The one building Aragorn could identify was the cathedral where the Razak had attacked him. Its flanged spire loomed above the rest of the city like a barbed spearhead. And somewhere in the landscape that rushed past below, Aragorn knew, were the remnants of the campsite where the Razak had mortally wounded Brom. He allowed all of his anger and grief over the events of that day, as well as Garrow's murder and the destruction of their farm, to surge forth and give him the courage, nay, the desire, to face the Razak in combat.
Aragorn, said Saphira. Today We need not guard our minds and keep our thoughts secret from one another, do we?
Not unless another magician should appear. A fan of golden light flared into existence as the top of the sun crested the horizon. In an instant, the full spectrum of colours enlivened the previously drab world. The mist glowed white, the water became a rich blue, the daubed mud wall that encircled the centre of Drasleona revealed its dingy yellow sides. The trees cloaked themselves in every shade of green, and the soil blushed red and orange. Hellgrind, however, remained as it always was. Black. The mountain of stone rapidly grew larger as they approached. Even from the air, it was intimidating. Diving toward the base of Hellgrind, Saphira tilted so far to her left, Aragorn and Roran would have fallen if they had not already strapped their legs to the saddle. Then she whipped around the apron of scree and over the altar where the priests of Hellgrind observed their ceremonies. The lip of Aragorn's helm caught the wind from her passage and produced a howl that almost deafened him.
"Well?"
shouted Roran. He could not see in front of them.
"The slaves are gone."
A great weight seemed to press Aragorn into his seat as Saphira pulled out of her dive and spiraled up around Hellgrind, searching for an entrance to the Razak's hideout.
"Not even a hole big enough for a wood rat,"
she declared. She slowed and hung in place before a ridge that connected the third lowest of the four peaks to the prominence above. The jagged buttress magnified the boom produced by each stroke of her wings until it was as loud as a thunderclap. Aragorn's eyes watered as the air pulsed against his skin. A web of white veins adorned the backside of the crags and pillars, where hoarfrost had collected in the cracks that furrowed the rock. Nothing else disturbed the gloom of Hellgrind's inky, windswept ramparts. No trees grew among the slanting stones, nor shrubs, grass, or lichen, nor did eagles dare nest upon the tower's broken ledges. True to its name, Hellgrind was a place of death, and stood cloaked in the razor-sharp, saw-tooth folds of its scarps and clefts, like a bony spectre risen to haunt the earth. Casting his mind outward, Aragorn confirmed the presence of the two people whom he had discovered imprisoned within Hellgrind the previous day. But he felt nothing of the slaves, and to his concern he still could not locate the Razak or the Leatherblaker.
"If they aren't here, then where?"
he wondered. Searching again, he noticed something that had eluded him before. A single flower, a gentian, blooming not 50 feet in front of them, where by all rights there ought to be solid rock. How does it get enough light to live? Saphira answered his question by perching on a crumbling spur several feet to the right. As she did, she lost her balance for a moment and flared her wings to steady herself. Instead of brushing against the bulk of Hellgrind, the tip of her right wing dipped into the rock and then back out again.
"Saphira, did you see that?"
"I did."
Leaning forward, Saphira pushed the tip of her snout toward the sheer rock, paused an inch or two away as if waiting for a trap to spring, then continued her advance. Scale by scale, Saphira's head slid into Hellgrind, until all that was visible of her to Aragorn was a neck, torso, and wings.
"It's an illusion!"
exclaimed Saphira. With a surge of her mighty thews, she abandoned the spur and flung the rest of her body after her head. It required every bit of Aragorn's self-control not to cover his face in a desperate bid to protect himself as the crag rushed toward him. An instant later, he found himself looking at a broad, vaulted cave, suffused with the warm glow of morning. Saphira's scales refracted the light, casting thousands of shifting blue flecks across the rock. Twisting around, Aragorn saw no wall behind them. only the mouth of the cave and a sweeping view of the landscape beyond. Aragorn grimaced. It had never occurred to him that Galbatorix might have hidden the Razak's lair with magic.
Idiot! I have to do better, he thought.
Underestimating the king was a sure way to get them all killed. Roran swore and said,
Warn me before you do something like that again.
Hunching forward, Aragorn began to unbuckle his legs from the saddle as he studied their surroundings, alert for danger. The opening to the cave was an irregular oval, perhaps 50 feet high and 60 feet wide. From there the chamber expanded to twice that size, before ending a good bowshot away in a pile of thick stone slabs that leaned against each other in a confusion of uncertain angles. A mat of scratches defaced the floor, evidence of the many times the Leatherblaka had taken off from, landed on, and walked about its surface. Like mysterious keyholes, 5 low tunnels pierced the sides of the cave, as did a lancet passageway large enough to accommodate Sephira. Aragorn examined the tunnels carefully, but they were pitch black and appeared vacant, a fact he confirmed with quick thrusts of his mind. Strange, disjointed murmurs echoed from within Helgrind's innards, suggesting unknown things scurrying about in the dark, and endlessly dripping water. Adding to the chorus of whispers was the steady rise and fall of Sephira's breathing, which was over-loud in the confines of the bare chamber. The most distinctive feature of the cavern, however, was the mixture of odours that pervaded it. The smell of cold stone dominated, but underneath Aragorn discerned whiffs of damp and mould, and something far worse. The sickly, sweet fetor of rotting meat. Undoing the last few straps, Aragorn swung his right leg over Sephira's spine, so he was sitting side-saddle, and prepared to jump off her back. Roran did the same on the opposite side. Before he released his hold, Aragorn heard amid the many rustlings that teased his ear, a score of simultaneous clicks, as if someone had struck the rock with a collection of hammers. The sound repeated itself a half-second later. He looked in the direction of the noise, as did Sephira. A huge, twisted shape hurtled out of the lancet passageway. Eyes black, bulging, rimless. A beak 7 feet long, bat-like wings, the torso naked, hairless, rippling with muscle, claws like iron spikes. Sephira lurched as she tried to evade the Leatherblaka, but to no avail. The creature crashed into her right side with what felt to Aragorn like the strength and fury of an avalanche. What exactly happened next, he knew not, for the impact sent him tumbling through space without so much as a half-formed thought in his jumbled brain. His blind flight ended as abruptly as it began, when something hard and flat rammed against the back of him, and he dropped to the floor, banging his head a second time. That last collision drove the remaining air clean out of Aragorn's lungs. Stunned, he lay curled on his side, gasping and struggling to regain a semblance of control over his unresponsive limbs.
"Aragorn!" cried Sephira.
The concern in her voice fueled Aragorn's efforts as nothing else could. As life returned to his arms and legs, he reached out and grasped his staff from where it had fallen beside him. He planted the spike mounted on the staff's lower end into a nearby crack and pulled himself up the hawthorn rod and onto his feet. He swayed. A swarm of crimson sparks danced before him. The situation was so confusing, he hardly knew where to look first. Sephira and the Leatherblaka rolled across the cave, kicking and clawing and snapping at each other with enough force to gouge the rock beneath them. The clamour of their fight must have been unimaginably loud, but to Aragorn they grappled in silence. His ears did not work. Still, he felt the vibrations through the soles of his feet as the colossal beasts thrashed from side to side, threatening to crush anyone who came near them. A torrent of blue fire erupted from between Saphira's jaws and bathed the left side of the leather-blucker's head in a ravening inferno hot enough to melt steel. The flames curved around the leather-blucker without harming it. Undeterred, the monster pecked at Saphira's neck, forcing her to stop and defend herself. Fast as an arrow loosed from a bow, the second leather-blucker darted out of the lancet passageway, pounced upon Saphira's flank, and opening its narrow beak, uttered a horrible, withering shriek that made Aragorn's scalp prickle, and a cold lump of dread form in his gut. He snarled in discomfort. That he could hear. The smell, now, with both leather-blucker present, resembled the sort of overpowering stench one would get from tossing a half-dozen pounds of rancid meat into a barrel of sewage and allowing the mixture to ferment for a week in summer. Aragorn clamped his mouth shut as his gorge rose and turned his attention elsewhere to keep from retching. A few paces away, Roran lay crumpled against the side of the cave where he too had landed. Even as Aragorn watched, his cousin lifted an arm and pushed himself onto all fours and then to his feet. His eyes were glazed and he tottered as if drunk. Behind Roran, the two Razak emerged from a nearby tunnel. They wielded long, pale blades of an ancient design in their malformed hands. Unlike their parents, the Razak were roughly the same size and shape as humans. An ebony exoskeleton encased them from top to bottom, although little of it showed, for even in Helgrind, the Razak wore dark robes and cloaks. They advanced with startling swiftness, their movements sharp and jerky like those of an insect. And yet Aragorn still could not sense them or the leather-blucker. Are they an illusion too? He wondered. But no, that was nonsense. The flesh Saphira tore at with her talons was real enough. Another explanation occurred to him. Perhaps it was impossible to detect their presence. Perhaps the Razak could conceal themselves from the minds of humans, their prey, just as spiders conceal themselves from flies. If so, then Aragorn finally understood why the Razak had been so successful hunting magicians and riders for Galbatorix, when they themselves could not use magic. Blast! Aragorn would have indulged in more colourful oaths, but it was time for action, not cursing their bad luck. Brom had claimed the Razak were no match for him in broad daylight, and while that might have been true, given that Brom had had decades to invent spells to use against the Razak, Aragorn knew that without the advantage of surprise, he, Saphira and Roran would be hard-pressed to escape with their lives, much less rescue Katrina. Raising his right hand above his head, Aragorn cried, "Brisingr!" and threw a roaring fireball toward the Razak. They dodged, and the fireball splashed against the rock floor, guttered for a moment, and then winked out of existence. The spell was silly and childish, and could cause no conceivable damage if Galbatorix had protected the Razak like the leather-blucker. Still, Aragorn found the attack immensely satisfying. It also distracted the Razak long enough for Aragorn to dash over to Roran and press his back against his cousins. "Hold them off for a minute," he shouted, hoping Roran would hear. Whether he did or not, Roran grasped Aragorn's meaning, for he covered himself with his shield and lifted his hammer in preparation to fight. The amount of force contained within each of the leather-blucker's terrible blows had already depleted the wards against physical danger that Aragorn had placed around Saphira. Without them, the leather-blucker had inflicted several rows of scratches, long but shallow, along her thighs, and had managed to stab her 3 times with their beaks. Those wounds were short but deep, and caused her a great deal of pain. In return, Saphira had laid open the ribs of one leather-blucker, and had bitten off the last 3 feet of the other's tail. The leather-blucker's blood, to Aragorn's astonishment, was a metallic blue-green, not unlike the verdigris that forms on aged copper. At the moment, the leather-blucker had withdrawn from Saphira and was circling her, lunging now and then in order to keep her at bay while they waited for her to tire, or until they could kill her with a stab from one of their beaks. Saphira was better suited than the Leatherblacker to open combat, by virtue of her scales, which were harder and tougher than the Leatherblacker's grey hide, and her teeth, which were far more lethal in close quarters than the Leatherblacker's beaks. But despite all that, she had difficulty fending off both creatures at once, especially since the ceiling prevented her from leaping and flying about and otherwise outmaneuvering her foes. Aragorn feared that even if she prevailed, the Leatherblacker would maim her before she slew them. Taking a quick breath, Aragorn cast a single spell that contained every one of the 12 techniques of killing that Oromis had taught him. He was careful to phrase the incantation as a series of processes, so that if Galbatorix's wards foiled him, he could sever the flow of magic. Otherwise the spell might consume his strength until he died. It was well he took the precaution. Upon release of the spell, Aragorn quickly became aware that the magic was having no effect upon the Leatherblacker, and he abandoned the assault. He had not expected to succeed with the traditional death words, but he had to try. On the slight chance Galbatorix might have been careless or ignorant when he had placed wards upon the Leatherblacker and their spawn. Behind him, Roran shouted, "Yah!" An instant later, a sword thudded against his shield, followed by the tinkle of rippling mail and the bell-like peal of a second sword, bouncing off Roran's helm. Aragorn realized that his hearing must be improving. The Razak struck again and again, but each time their weapons glanced off Roran's armor, or missed his face and limbs by a hair's breadth, no matter how fast they swung their blades. Roran was too slow to retaliate, but neither could the Razak harm him. They hissed with frustration and spewed a continuous stream of invectives, which seemed all the more foul because of how the creature's hard, clacking jaws mangled the language. Aragorn smiled. The cocoon of charms he had spun around Roran had done its job. He hoped the invisible net of energy would hold until he could find a way to halt the Leatherblacker. Everything shivered and went grey around Aragorn, as the two Leatherblacker shrieked in unison. For a moment his resolve deserted him, leaving him unable to move. Then he rallied and shook himself as a dog might, casting off their fell influence. The sound reminded him of nothing so much as a pair of children screaming in pain. Then Aragorn began to chant as fast as he could without mispronouncing the ancient language. Each sentence he uttered, and they were legion, contained the potential to deliver instant death, and each death was unique among its fellows. As he recited his improvised soliloquy, Saphira received another cut upon her left flank. In return, she broke the wing of her assailant, slashing the thin flight membrane into ribbons with her claws. A number of heavy impacts transmitted themselves from Roran's back to Aragorn's, as the Razak hacked and stabbed in a lightning-quick frenzy. The largest of the two Razak began to edge around Roran in order to attack Aragorn directly. And then, amid the din of steel against steel and steel against wood and claws against stone, there came the scrape of a sword sliding through mail, followed by a wet crunch. Roran yelled, and Aragorn felt blood splash across the calf of his right leg. Out of the corner of one eye, Aragorn watched as a humpbacked figure leaped toward him, extending its leaf-bladed sword so as to impale him. The world seemed to contract around the thin, narrow point. The tip glittered like a shard of crystal, each scratch a thread of quicksilver in the bright light of dawn. He only had time for one more spell before he would have to devote himself to stopping the Razak from inserting the sword between his liver and kidneys. In desperation, he gave up trying to directly harm the Leatherblacker, and instead cried, "Gajdla Leta!" It was a crude spell, constructed in haste and poorly worded. Yet it worked. The bulbous eyes of the Leatherblacker with the broken wing became a matched set of mirrors, each a perfect hemisphere, as Aragorn's magic reflected the light that otherwise would have entered the Leatherblacker's pupils. Blind, the creature stumbled and flailed at the air in a vain attempt to hit Saphira. Aragorn spun the hawthorn staff in his hands and knocked aside the Razak sword when it was less than an inch from his ribs. The Razak landed in front of him and jutted out its neck. Aragorn recoiled as a short, thick beak appeared from within the depths of its hood. The chitinous appendage snapped shut just short of his right eye. In a rather detached way, Aragorn noticed that the Razak's tongue was barbed and purple, and writhed like a headless snake. Bringing his hands together at the center of the staff, Aragorn drove his arms forward, striking the Razak across its hollow chest, and throwing the monster back several yards. It fell upon its hands and knees. Aragorn pivoted around Roran, whose left side was slick with blood, and parried the sword of the other Razak. He fainted, beat the Razak's blade, and when the Razak stabbed at his throat, whirled the other half of the staff across his body and deflected the thrust. Without pausing, Aragorn lunged forward and planted the wooden end of the staff in the Razak's abdomen. If Aragorn had been wielding Zarok, he would have killed the Razak then and there. As it was, something cracked inside the Razak, and the creature went rolling across the cave for a dozen or more paces. It immediately popped up again, leaving a smear of blue gore on the uneven rock. "I need a sword," thought Aragorn. He widened his stance as the two Razak converged upon him. He had no choice but to hold his ground and face their combined onslaught, for he was all that stood between those hook-clawed carrion crows and Roran. He began to mount the same spell that had proved itself against the Levelblacker, but the Razak executed high and low slashes before he could utter a syllable. The swords rebounded off the hawthorn with a dull bonk. They did not dent or otherwise mar the enchanted wood. Left, right, up, down, Aragorn did not think. He acted and reacted as he exchanged a flurry of blows with the Razak. The staff was ideal for fighting multiple opponents, as he could strike and block with both ends, and often simultaneously. That ability served him well now. He panted, each breath short and quick. Sweat dripped from his brow and gathered at the corners of his eyes, and a layer greased his back and the undersides of his arms. The red haze of battle dimmed his vision and throbbed in response to the convulsions of his heart. He never felt so alive or afraid as he did when fighting. Aragorn's own wards were scant. Since he had lavished the bulk of his attention on Saphira and Roran, Aragorn's magical defences soon failed, and the smaller Razak wounded him on the outside of his left knee. The injury was not life-threatening, but it was still serious, for his left leg would no longer support his full weight. Gripping the spike at the bottom, Aragorn swung the staff like a club and bashed one Razak upside the head. The Razak collapsed, but whether it was dead or only unconscious, Aragorn could not tell. Advancing upon the remaining Razak, he battered the creature's arms and shoulders and with a sudden twist knocked the sword out of its hand. Before Aragorn could finish off the Razak, the blinded, broken-winged Leatherblacker flew the width of the cave and slammed against the far wall, knocking loose a shower of stone flakes from the ceiling. The sight and sound were so colossal they caused Aragorn, Roran, and the Razak to flinch and turn simply out of instinct. Jumping after the crippled Leatherblacker, which she had just kicked, Saphira sank her teeth into the back of the creature's sinewy neck. The Leatherblacker thrashed in one final effort to free itself, and then Saphira whipped her head from side to side and broke its spine. Rising from her bloody kill, Saphira filled the cave with a savage roar of victory. The remaining Leatherblacker did not hesitate. Tackling Saphira, it dug its claws underneath the edges of her scales and pulled her into an uncontrollable tumble. Together, they rolled to the lip of the cave, teetered for a half second, and then dropped out of sight, battling the whole way. It was a clever tactic, for it carried the Leatherblacker out of the range of Aragorn's senses, and that which he could not sense, he had difficulty casting a spell against. "Saphira!" cried Aragorn.
"Tend to yourself," This one won't escape me!
With a start, Aragorn whirled around just in time to see the two Razak vanish into the depths of the nearest tunnel, the smaller supporting the larger. Closing his eyes, Aragorn located the minds of the prisoners in Helgrind, muttered a burst of the ancient language, then said to Roran, I sealed off Katrina's cell, so the Razak can't use her as a hostage. Only you and I can open the door now.
Good, said Roran through clenched teeth. Can you do something about this?
He jerked his chin toward the spot he had clapped his right hand over. Blood welled between his fingers. Aragorn probed the wound. As soon as he touched it, Roran flinched and recoiled. You're lucky, said Aragorn. The sword hit a rib. Placing one hand on the injury and the other on the 12 diamonds concealed inside the belt of Beloth the Wise, strapped around his waist, Aragorn drew upon the power he had stored within the gems.
Weissa heal!
A ripple traversed Roran's side as the magic knit his skin and muscle back together again. Then Aragorn healed his own wound, the gash on his left knee. Finished, he straightened and glanced in the direction that Saphira had gone. His connection with her was fading as she chased the leatherblucker toward Leona Lake. He yearned to help her, but knew that for the time being, she would have to fend for herself.
Hurry, said Roran. They're getting away!
Right. Hefting his staff, Aragorn approached the unlit tunnel and flicked his gaze from one stone protrusion to another, expecting the Razak to spring out from behind one of them. He moved slowly in order that his footsteps would not echo in the winding shaft. When he happened to touch a rock to steady himself, he found it coated in slime. After a score of yards, several folds and twists in the passageway hid the main cavern and plunged them into a gloom so profound even Aragorn found it impossible to see.
Maybe you're different, but I can't fight in the dark, whispered Roran. If I make a light, the Razak won't come near us, not when I now know a spell that works on them. They'll just hide until we leave. We have to kill them while we have the chance. What am I supposed to do? I'm more likely to run into a wall and break my nose than I am to find those two beetles. They could sneak around behind us and stab us in the back. Shh! Hold on to my belt. Follow me and be ready to duck.
Aragorn could not see, but he could still hear, smell, touch and taste. And those faculties were sensitive enough that he had a fair idea of what lay nearby. The greatest danger was that the Razak would attack from a distance, perhaps with a bow, but he trusted that his reflexes were sharp enough to save Roran and himself from an oncoming missile. A current of air tickled Aragorn's skin, then paused and reversed itself as pressure from the outside waxed and waned. The cycle repeated itself at inconsistent intervals, creating invisible eddies that brushed against him like fountains of roiling water. His breathing and Roran's was loud and ragged compared with the odd assortment of sounds that propagated through the tunnel. Above the gusts of their respiration, Aragorn caught the tink-clink clatter of a stone falling somewhere in the tangle of branching tubes, and the steady doink, doink, doink of condensed droplets striking the drum-like surface of a subterranean pool. He also heard the grind of pea-sized gravel crushed underneath the soles of his boots. A long, eerie moan wavered somewhere far ahead of them. Of smells, none were new. Sweat, blood, damp, and mould. Step by step, Aragorn led the way as they burrowed farther into the bowels of Helgrind. The tunnel slanted downward and often split or turned, so that Aragorn would have soon been lost if he had not been able to use Katrina's mind as a reference point. The various knobby holes were low and cramped. Once, when Aragorn bumped his head against the ceiling, a sudden flare of claustrophobia unnerved him.
I'm back!
Saphira announced, just as Aragorn put his foot on a rugged step hewn out of the rock below him. He paused. She had escaped additional injury, which relieved him.
And the leather blucker?
floating belly up in Leona Lake. I'm afraid that some fishermen saw our battle. They were rowing toward Dras Leona when I last saw them.
Well, it can't be helped. See what you can find in the tunnel the leather blocker came out of, and keep an eye out for